From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll look ahead to the first election in Wisconsin with new legislative district maps in place. We'll tell you about the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act and what rights it guarantees for pregnant people in the workplace.
Something like a water break or a bathroom break or being able to rest or eat food. Those are accommodations that, believe it or not, were being denied to pregnant workers before the act.
Plus, we'll tell you about a different way to take a camping trip down the Wisconsin River.
When you're going down this river valley, you're kind of surrounded by these tree-lined bluffs on both sides. You've just got these big, beautiful sandbars. I mean, imagine miles and miles of deserted beaches.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. It may be hard to believe, but Wisconsin has an election coming up, and we're not talking about the November presidential election. In less than a month, Wisconsinites will head to the polls to vote in the partisan primary for a variety of elected officials, including those in the state legislature. This will be the first election under new voting district maps. John Johnson is a research fellow at Marquette Law School's Lubar Center. And he's been paying close attention to how this election could impact politics in Wisconsin. He joins me now to talk about it. John, thank you so much for being here.
It's my pleasure.
We have a primary election that's coming up before, of course, the presidential election in November. Looking at this upcoming primary, how many of the districts will have contested primaries this August?
So out of the 99 assembly districts, there's an opportunity for there to be a Democratic primary and a Republican primary for each of them. 21 will have a contested Democratic primary, and 22 will have a contested Republican primary, 43 total. That compares to 31 total in 2022 and just 25 total in 2020. So there's about 780,000 more people in Wisconsin who live in a district that will have a competitive primary from either party this year than 2 years ago, and a little over a million more who will have the opportunity to vote in a competitive primary now than 4 years ago.
So out of those many primaries that are happening, which are the primaries that you're really watching?
In the Milwaukee Metro, there's a few that are quite interesting. One is the 19th Assembly District, which I'm sure some listeners live in. This is the one that stretches from the Upper East Side of Milwaukee down the lake through downtown all the way to the north end of Bayview. It's currently represented by Ryan Clancy, who's one of the most left-wing members of the Democratic Party in the State Assembly. He's actually a member of the Democratic Socialists of America, one of two of that political organization's members in the State Assembly. And Clancy has drawn a Democratic primary challenger, Jared Anderson, who's a more moderate Democrat. I doubt he would describe himself as a moderate, but certainly not as left-wing as Clancy. And Anderson has drawn quite a few endorsements from prominent Democrats in the city, including, I believe, the mayor. So that's going to be such an interesting primary to watch because it's a really Democratic-leaning district. And so in general elections, you don't learn much about the district because they're mostly Democrats and they vote in a similar way from one race to another. But this will be an opportunity for those internal differences within that Democratic Party supporting coalition to reveal themselves. I'll be watching that closely. We have a mirror image of that race in the 24th Assembly District, which mostly covers Menominee Falls, Germantown, that area in Washington County. The incumbent Assembly member Janelle Branchen is running for re-election there. She's one of the furthest right members of the state assembly, has been closely connected to a lot of the election denier activity following the 2020 presidential election. And she's drawn a challenger, Dan Knodel, also a longtime state legislator. Knodel is an ally of state Republican legislative leadership. No one would call him a moderate, I don't think, but he's certainly not as extreme as Branchen. And so in a similar way, that will give us an opportunity to see the relative strength of more mainstream and less mainstream Republicans in the Milwaukee suburbs. Then there's a set of open seats in Milwaukee. The 12th and 11th districts on the north side of the city are both open because Dora Drake and Lakeisha Myers are running to replace Lena Taylor in the state Senate. And so several candidates have declared candidacies in the Democratic primary there. Also, the 18th district on the near west and sort of near north sides of the city, stretching into Wauwatosa, that longtime incumbent Evan Goyke has left the assembly to become the city attorney for Milwaukee. There are at least two Democrats running there. We also see a competitive Democratic primary in the 14th district, which covers most of West Allis, and a competitive Republican primary in the 61st district, which covers Hales Corners, Greendale, and a lot of Greenfield.
We know that given the new maps, it's very likely the Wisconsin Assembly is going to look very different come November, or really come 2025, I should say. But the Senate is a little different in this way. Now, there are a number of seats that are up for election. Are there any that you're really watching right now?
Yeah, so there's no chance that Democrats will take a majority of the state Senate, no realistic chance, because only half the seats are up in a given year. But if they do well this year, they'll set themselves up to be in a good position to potentially take the majority in 2026 when the other set of seats come up for election. And the seat that is most competitive in the Milwaukee Metro is the 8th Senate District, which covers some of Milwaukee's North Shore, Whitefish Bay, Bayside, Fox Point, River Hills, and stretches into northern Ozaukee County and Mequon, Cedarburg, Port Washington. This is a little bit of a rematch. The Democratic candidate, Jody Habush-Sintkin, I may have mispronounced her name, apologize if so, is running against a longtime Republican state assembly member. And so that seat, if the Democratic candidate wins, and she did quite well in a different version of that seat in a special election. Special elections are difficult to extrapolate to general elections, but the district has been drawn in such a way that it's more Democratic leaning than that version of the district that she previously ran in. If she wins that seat, that would suggest that Democrats have also done well in the other slightly more Democratic leaning Senate seats elsewhere in the state, particularly in the Madison area that they'll be contesting. So if Democrats win that seat, I would say they would be in a very good position, possibly even favorites, to take the state Senate in 2026.
Now, looking ahead to November, how many districts are likely to be competitive? We know that the Senate, of course, it's only going to be half of the seats that are up, really, but all of the assembly will be up for election.
I think there's really about 8 seats that are quite competitive around the state. There's a couple in Green Bay, one around Wausau, one around Stevens Point, a couple in the La Crosse area, a couple around Eau Claire, one on the suburbs with the Twin Cities on the border there. But in the Milwaukee Metro, there aren't too many, but there are a couple. The 21st Assembly District, which covers Oak Creek and now stretches into the southern city of Milwaukee, is a seat that's been sort of on paper competitive for Democrats in the past, but it has leaned Republican, and Republicans have had a strong candidate there in Jesse Rodriguez, a Republican from Oak Creek. But the district now leans more Republican, and a Democratic named David Marstellar is running against Rodriguez, and I expect that one to be very competitive. Democrats are really hoping to win that seat. Another one is the 61st district, which covers Greendale, Hales Corners, that area. Bob Donovan, the former Milwaukee alderman, candidate for mayor, now a member of the state assembly, is running there. He's essentially the incumbent, even though the number has changed, because a lot of that district is the district that he previously represented. And in fact, he's running against Luann Bird, who's, I believe, the sole Democratic candidate on the ballot who he ran against last time.
It seems like, really inevitably, the legislature is going to look different than it has over the past 10, 15 years because of these new maps. What kind of impact is this going to have on the legislature? What is the legislature likely to look like come 2025?
There's every likelihood that there will be 10 or so more Democrats, and maybe more. You know, Democrats have a shot at winning a majority of the assembly. I would say they're not favored to do so, and a lot will depend on the result of the top of the ticket. We know that the vote in presidential races has a lot to do with the vote in down ballot races, especially as fewer and fewer people split their tickets. There aren't very many people who are more motivated to vote by an obscure state legislative election, no matter how consequential those might be, relative to a marquee presidential race. So, of course, things will be very different if Democrats win a majority of the assembly. In that scenario, I think we would see a lot of legislative gridlock because we anticipate that Republicans will still have a majority of the state Senate. I think it's also possible that Republicans remain in power in the state assembly, but with a much, much smaller majority. Probably the most immediately significant thing that will change is that Republicans will no longer have a supermajority in the state Senate. Currently, they have a supermajority there and almost, but not quite, a supermajority in the assembly. But the consequence of that has been that Democratic assembly members have had to work really hard to make sure that they're all able to get to the Capitol on short notice to prevent veto overrides. There's going to be much less of a threat of veto overrides after this election because the Republican majority, if it remains, will be smaller in both chambers, almost certainly.
Well, we will see what happens. John Johnson, thank you as always for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me.
John Johnson is a research fellow at Marquette Law School's Lubar Center. Wisconsin's primary election will be held on Tuesday, August 13th. You can find more information about the election at wuwm.com/election. In about 20 minutes, we'll bring you the latest Wandering Wisconsin, where we help you plan a trip right here in our home state. This one is all about a unique camping experience you can't find anywhere else. But first, we'll tell you about the recently enacted Pregnant Workers Fairness Act. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The Pregnant Workers Fairness Act was passed into law in June. It ensures pregnant workers or those who have recently given birth get reasonable accommodations on the job. Things like being able to take time off for medical needs, water breaks, and the ability to take on a lighter load. The PWFA applies across industries to businesses with 15 or more employees. To learn about the new federal rules from the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski speaks with its chair, Charlotte Burrows.
Before this act specifically, what kind of protections, or lack thereof for that matter, did pregnant people have in the workplace?
So there was already on the books, under the Civil Rights Act of 1964, Title VII of that act prevented someone from being fired just because they were pregnant. But at the same time, if you needed some sort of accommodation, like lifting, it wasn't always clear that you couldn't be fired for not being able to, for not getting the accommodation, or that you had a right to it. That was really a question of the particular instances. And so it left pregnant workers having to wonder whether or not they were going to be able to keep their income. The other law that sometimes was of help, but not always, to pregnant workers was the Americans with Disabilities Act. So if you had something that was significant and serious enough of a limitation that it was covered as a disability, then you were able to also get those protections. But I will tell you, even in those situations where those other laws covered the circumstances, we saw some problems, and we had a really heartbreaking pregnancy and disability discrimination lawsuit on behalf of a retail worker whose employer had denied her medical leave when she was experiencing a pregnancy-related emergency. And that employee actually was forced to quit just to access urgent care. But she didn't get it in time and ended up miscarrying the same day. So there were real horror stories out there before the law, and we are hopeful that that kind of thing, as the awareness of this law and these particular protections for pregnant workers and postpartum workers sets in, that we'll not have that kind of really avoidable problem.
And as you mentioned, some things were covered since the 60s, but this is decades of people, unfortunately, having to figure this out, right, without specific accommodations like the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act. I'm wondering, on your end, what difficulties came up when the EEOC was first drafting this regulation? Because this is 2024, right? And people were going off a basis since the Civil Rights Act.
Yes, absolutely. Well, what's interesting about that process is that it was something where the clear direction from Congress was to draft examples. And so those were the kinds of things that we focused on. And I would say, I don't know if it was difficult, but we wanted to really be as practical as possible about what would come up in the real world. And so that was our focus. We did have, as you note, the language that Congress lifted from the 1978 amendment to that law, which was the Pregnancy Discrimination Act. So pregnancy, childbirth, and related medical conditions came from that. So we had some guidance from past case law, et cetera. But I think the real difficulty was we felt a lot of urgency to work quickly and also to just be as practical as possible so that it could be clear to folks, both employers and employees, exactly what their expectations could be.
Right. And to put it again, summarize simply, the PFWA states that people have the right to ask their employer for an accommodation or change at work in order to help them do their job. But this can be intimidating, especially if there's not a large precedence for it in someone's individual workplace. So can you share any tips or guidance as to how someone can approach their employer to ask for reasonable accommodations?
Absolutely. Well, this is not a complicated process. And there are no magic words that someone needs to use. The employee should just tell the employer that they have a limitation and that they need some sort of adjustment or change to working conditions because of it. And that limitation, of course, has to be related to pregnancy, childbirth, or related medical conditions. But it could be as simple as the worker saying, hey, I've got some trouble getting to work at my scheduled start time because I'm having morning sickness. Can I come in a little later? Or saying, I need time off from work to attend a medical appointment because of my pregnancy, or I need more bathroom breaks because of my pregnancy. So the employee can make that request to a supervisor or someone who assigns the employee work. And then the employer and the employee just communicate about what the limitation is and the adjustment or change that's needed. And the EEOC really expects that most requests can be granted pretty quickly through this kind of conversation. So the employer really should respond promptly. And in most instances, this should be something that the employer employee can work out.
Can an employer request a doctor's note? Like, what is and isn't protected when it comes to medical information in order to request accommodations around pregnancy?
So it really depends on the circumstances. There are some things that are not going to be evident to the employer. And because the law also requires them, if they can't do what the employee first requests, to really communicate and have a back and forth to figure out if something else could be done instead, they need some information about what the limitation, what would cover the circumstances and what would make the employee able to continue to work. But there are certain things that will be obvious. So, and in that case would not require a lot of documentation. And I'll just say, if the employee asked for a bigger uniform and that uniform, it was, you know, they're not the same size that they were in their first trimester, then asking for a lot of documentation really doesn't make sense, right? The same thing for something like a water break or a bathroom break, or being able to rest or eat food. Those are accommodations that, believe it or not, were being denied to pregnant workers before the act, those things really shouldn't require a lot of documentation, but other things will, and it sort of depends on the circumstances.
I see. And an employer doesn't have to provide a reasonable accommodation under the PFWA if it causes the employer an undue hardship. So what exactly does an undue hardship mean? What is that qualification?
Sure. So really, undue hardship just simply means something that would be significant difficulty or significant expense for the employer. And that is measured vis-a-vis the employer's actual resources and the size of the employer and, you know, frankly, how much money they have in order to deal with it. So some employer that may have only 15 or 16 employees would not necessarily be able to do everything that a large multinational corporation could do. So it's read through that lens, but basically it just means significant difficulty or significant expense to the employer.
So when it comes to the risks that are involved with working while pregnant, this obviously will help a lot of people, but who is most at risk of maternal morbidity and mortality due to a lack of accommodations, you know, for example, in strenuous jobs that could be dangerous to do during a pregnancy?
Now, that's an excellent, excellent point. I mean, there are a lot of sort of obvious implications for persons who have lifting requirements while they're pregnant that they need. Those are classic kinds of things that need to be accommodated. But really, it because the kinds of medical conditions that may crop up during pregnancy or afterwards may vary, it really isn't limited just to those positions that have manual labor. And what you're looking at is a question of having the individual employee being able to continue to, earn at a time when they're going to have an addition to the family. And so, for instance, the example that I gave about the employee who ended up miscarrying because the employer would not give her reasonable time to go to the emergency room, and so therefore she was delayed in getting urgent care, that was someone who was in a retail job. And so really, because health is so variable, I'm not sure you can limit it to just one kind of worker or one kind of industry, which is precisely why it was important to have a clear federal statute that applied to everyone.
We've talked about some of the risks, but can you share any examples of how this act has benefited workers?
Well, it's early days yet, but what we're hearing is that it's made it a lot simpler to have those accommodation discussions because employees feel more confident that they can say, hey, here's the rule, and work things out that way. And so things like feeling more confident when you have to go to the doctor, that won't cause, stress or problems at work. And I should say that the law not only requires accommodations unless it's going to be an undue hardship, but it also prohibits retaliation, and that's a separate protected area so that a lot of people, may be afraid to even raise the subject of an accommodation for fear there will be some sort of retaliation. And so it's really important that that's there as well.
Definitely. As you mentioned, it's early days, and this is one big step forward. But the United States, for example, still doesn't have universal parental leave, and we're behind in a lot of other places when it comes to time off and care around pregnancy. So in your experience, do you think the climate is shifting to help change more, even in addition to this?
I do. I think that the law is really reflecting the values that most of us hold in America. And you see that in the broad bipartisan majorities in both the House and the Senate when the law was passed. And so I really take encouragement from that. But there are still those outlier situations where it's really important that there be a law with teeth that, ensures that the practices in the workplace move closer to our shared values as a nation, that we treat everybody with dignity and respect.
Well, Chair Burrows, thank you so much for joining me today to share more. I appreciate your time.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Charlotte Burrows is the chair of the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. She joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. Parks are a place for people to run off some energy, get a sense of adventure, and play with peers. But all of those things can look different for people living with a disability. Some paths aren't accessible for those with mobility devices. Some playgrounds don't accommodate visual or physical limitations. And many fields aren't built for wheelchair baseball. And if there are accessible components, the rest of the space might not be enticing for people without disabilities. That's why Damian Bookman, executive director of the Ability Center, wanted to create the Moss Universal Park. It's a first-of-its-kind area in Milwaukee where everyone can play, whether they have a disability or not. WUWM's Mayan Silver spoke with him to find out more.
So one of the key principles of this project is that everyone should have access to play and recreation whenever they want it. How is this message personal to you?
Well, it's a great question. So, you know, what makes this so personable for me is actually I was diagnosed with childhood cancer when I was 13 years old in my right leg and re-diagnosed in my left leg. So I've had 28 knee replacements and revisions since I was a kid. But more importantly, I'm a father of three boys, and I want to be able to play with my boys regardless of where my ability or mobility is found, and they want to play with me. And I think that's our most important message, is that we will build, you know, inclusive playgrounds for kids. And I think that that's really great. But every kid looks back to the adult who brought them: mom, dad, grandma, grandpa, aunt, uncle, teachers. Hey, look what I can do. And it's much better, much more fun, much more interactive when I can get in that play instead of just looking at that play. And the kids want to play with us too. So making sure that that park, that playground works for everyone is what's most important to us.
So for people who may or may not know, can you break down what makes a playground accessible? What makes a park accessible? That kind of thing.
Yeah. So, you know, if we can picture a playground, just about every playground sits inside of a park, right? And we believe that that whole park should be an inclusive and universal experience, not just the playground alone, that people should be able to explore the outside of that space. I think one of the major issues with inclusive playgrounds is their sense of adventure and their sense of danger and their sense of really wanting to be able to activate doesn't exist in many inclusive playgrounds, which what then that creates is just an opportunity for the able-bodied, you know, siblings and peers to feel a little bored and ready to leave. And let's be real, it probably gets boring pretty fast for kids with disabilities as well. So we've got to bring more activity, more adventure, more danger into the design. And then when we do that, that actually it provides and creates inclusive play, ultimately what we're looking for. If it's not an entertaining space to play, then those typically developing peers that come to play with their peers or siblings with disabilities, well, they're probably gone in 60 seconds or less. And they've already played on that element and that playground and that space, and they're no longer entertained and they're gone. So what we didn't create was that actual inclusion that we're looking for. We certainly created an accessible opportunities for kids and individuals with disabilities to play, but we didn't create inclusion if it's also not adventurous and dangerous and fun for the able-bodied kids.
And so can you break down engineering-wise or structural-wise, what are some of the components that make a playground and a park having those elements?
Yeah. Well, so from a playground perspective, you know, we're helping create the first ever wheelchair chute or wheelchair slide, if you will, that's never been done before. We've created something called Inclusion Tower, and we're talking about sensory needs to physical needs and challenges across the whole spectrum, right? And this will get kids that can have the capacity to climb that up to 12 feet. You know, not every child with a physical impairment is wheelchair bound. A lot of times, you know, society likes to say somebody is wheelchair bound. The reality is that they are wheelchair users, or they're a mobility device user. They don't need it at all times at, you know, of every second of every day. And so they can get out of that chair and climb something if they have that capacity. So that's what Inclusion Tower is. So imagine we're actually getting them 12 feet off the ground versus just 4 or 8, but also double wide ramps so that, you know, children who are wheelchair users are not in, you know, the way. They feel welcome, wanted, and comfortable when they're playing, and that they can interact in a multitude of ways. But then also usually ramp structures have one way in and one way out. It's the same thing. It's the same experience every time that a child plays that comes that has that need. And how much fun is that, right? When you think about a typically developing child or individuals, you know, we have ladders to climb, or we have nets to climb, or we have slides to climb, we have poles to climb. We have a lot of ways in and a lot of ways out of a structure. But a child who might be a wheelchair user has the same way in as the same way out. And my play experience never changes every time I come. So we have multiple way-ins, multiple ways out, not just the same experience in a structure, again, that brings that sense of adventure and danger by getting people up to 8 and 12 feet high versus maybe 2 to 4 feet high.
It's also been talked about that there will be a half mile accessible path through the woods that include a challenge course.
That's right.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so if we go beyond the playground, right, there's also a universal baseball field, something that's never been built before or designed before, that will be able to include a multitude of sports, including wheelchair football and wheelchair basketball. But if we merge ourselves into the forestry, everybody knows that nature is good for our mental health. And we like to say everybody deserves to hug a tree. And those trees are fantastic in the Milwaukee County parks. But if you can't get to the tree, does the tree really exist, is the question. And so we have created a half a mile meandering path that will go through about the 12 acres of the wooded area, even a spot where we call sensory escape or mental health valley, where you can get surrounded by nature and be kind of in a cocoon or a pod and escape from the visual activity, the auditory activity, the things that might just be too overwhelming. You can escape into that mental health valley. And so you can really get out into play pockets and fitness pockets and, yes, an inclusive challenge course. So our partner Game Time has created and a challenge course, but we as the Ability Center and a partner help say, well, how is that challenge course inclusive? And so we created an inclusive model where I can race against my typically developing friend or able-bodied friend, and we can play together. And it has sensory spaces inside of that challenge course as well. And so whether we're talking about intellectual and developmental disabilities to physical disabilities, that's what Universal is about. We're really thinking about everybody, all human experiences, and what people's needs are as individuals versus, you know, kind of a perceived collective whole.
You're tuned into Lake Effect. I'm WEWM's Ayan Silver, speaking with Damian Bookman of the Ability Center. So the park is on the west side of Milwaukee off of Wisconsin Avenue. Can you describe what's beneficial about the location of this park to serve people with disabilities?
That's a really great question. I mean, we chose the park specifically because of its equity for people with disabilities. So the location is less than a mile from the Level 1 trauma care center in the Milwaukee area. So Frederick Hospital, Children's Hospital, Medical College of Wisconsin, Ronald McDonald House. It's a block from the Milwaukee County Zoo. It's across the street from a significant elderly home known as St. Camillus and also Kitty Corner to Frederick's Rehab Hospital. It's on top of the zoo interchange. It is, you know, pretty close to the border of Milwaukee County and Waukesha County. And then it's also makes it accessible to Transit One, you know, van line systems for people who get transportation needs, but also the heaviest traveled bus route in the entire system of the Milwaukee County Transit, which allows for less mountains, if you will, that people have to climb in order to get to their ultimate destination. So really, from an accessibility and transport standpoint, this is the most accessible location from a Milwaukee County park perspective that people can get to and are familiar with the area.
So you've said you like opportunities for people with disabilities and people without disabilities, or rather people of all abilities, to play side by side and ideally together. Can you lay out some of your dreams of how this park will accomplish that?
I mean, the dream for me, I think, is the dream for everybody. It's ultimately that inclusion piece, right? So I already spoke earlier about how a lot of times inclusive playgrounds are low element, lack adventure, lack danger, lack a desire to really want to play. And so did we really create inclusion, or did we create an opportunity for kids with disabilities to play, which, don't get me wrong, is extraordinarily important, but we didn't create that inclusion. And oftentimes when we talk about things like the universal baseball field, many times those are separate on their own, not surrounded by typical able-bodied athletic baseball fields, but these are right next to each other. And so it creates that opportunity where you can have, say, a high school baseball game going alongside a Miracle League baseball game, and people are connecting together, seeing one another and seeing what their capabilities and their abilities really are. And that's what inclusion is. A community comes with people who are, you know, blind or visually impaired or deaf or hard of hearing or, you know, physically challenged or sensory issues or autism or Down syndrome or typically developing or neurotypical. I mean, it's all of the things, right? And that's what we're saying. That's what universal is. We're saying that from the fields to the forestry, from the playground to the fitness, from the bathroom, you know, and special care needs to temperature regulation, we don't want anybody to leave the park until they're exhausted, not because they have some kind of special care need. And that's what community inclusion looks like. And that's the lens we're using when we design these opportunities. And you hit it right on the head. It is all about opportunity. Is the opportunity equal? Is the opportunity accessible? Are the opportunities, right? And I think that's key in the plurality of it. Are the opportunities available?
Damian Bookman of the Ability Center, thanks so much for speaking to us about Maas Universal Park.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having us on and allowing us to share the vision and the dream and the passion and the need so that we can be a more inclusive community.
Damian Bookman is the executive director of the Ability Center. He spoke with WUWM's Mayan Silver last year. The park is planned to be fully open this fall. Coming up, we'll help you plan a canoeing or kayaking trip down the Wisconsin River, where you can spend the night on a sandbar. We'll tell you all about it next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Going camping is a favorite summer pastime for many Wisconsinites. Summer is also a great time to explore Wisconsin's many scenic waterways. In this month's Wandering Wisconsin, we'll help you plan a trip where you can do both. The Wisconsin Canoe Company offers canoe and kayak rentals and the opportunity to spend the night on a sandbar in the middle of the Wisconsin River. To share how it all works, Lake Effect's Becky Mortensen is joined by Ryan Schmudlock, the owner of the Wisconsin Canoe Company, and Amanda Weibel, the communications officer for Travel Wisconsin.
Ryan and Amanda, welcome to Lake Effect. Thank you for joining me for Wandering Wisconsin.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, happy to be a part of this.
The Wisconsin Canoe Company calls what you offer a paddling experience for outdoor enthusiasts of all levels. So you all offer a variety of things, and I'm going to start with the more beginner level, so that's day trips. Ryan, can you share a bit about what that experience would be like?
Yeah, so, you know, day trips on the Wisconsin, if you can't go overnight, day trip is certainly better than nothing. You know, imagine this riverway, the last 92 miles of it have been protected from development for several decades now, and there wasn't a lot of development to begin with out there. And so when you're going down this river valley, you're kind of surrounded by these tree-lined bluffs on both sides, no houses, no docks, no motorboats, really. You've just got these big, beautiful sandbars. I mean, imagine miles and miles of deserted beaches, and you can, you know, kind of paddle up, coast onto anyone you see that you like, hang out for a little while, have some lunch, play in the water, jump off the sandbars. You know, for being a guy that lives in a van down by the river, you know, it's kind of hard for me to really put this into words. It's just kind of something you have to experience.
Yeah, so now overnight trips. You say the sandbars are the reason people do these trips. So what's an overnight canoe trip like on the Wisconsin River?
Yeah, so going overnight, you know, you've still got the scenic value during the day. But what I love about it is, you know, as the sun starts to go down, everything kind of quiets down and it's just incredibly serene out there. You know, there's the animals, the turtles, the eagles are out and about. And then as the sun goes down, you're feeling this quietness settle over the valley and you're kind of alone out there almost. And it's just an experience you don't really get in the Midwest. It's fairly unique. You know, it does bring its interesting points where, you know, you are in a sandbar, you are in the middle of nowhere. And it's just so much different than what you might expect going to a state park campsite. You know, this is still an organization or a part of the DNR, but it's not a state park. It's its own unique thing.
So pretty unique camping experience.
For sure.
So let's talk about how you'd recommend people get ready for an overnight stay with, kind of like you said, basically no amenities besides what nature has to offer. So what should people know and plan to bring?
So going down the Wisconsin River, it's a dispersed kind of camping experience. You know, there are no campsite numbers. There's no fire pits. There's no picnic tables. There's no bathrooms. So it's kind of everything that you're going to bring, you need to bring with you. And so this is kind of a nice intro, really, if you're not used to dispersed camping. There's not portaging. There's plenty of room in your canoe. And so you can have those amenities like a cooler with ice. You can bring all of your big, bulky camping gear. It doesn't have to be this ultralight setup or anything like that. It helps that a lot of people have everything you would already need to go out on the river. Some kind of unique challenges are, you know, I mentioned the lack of bathrooms. That's one that can kind of surprise people a little bit. You have options. You can always bring a little portable toilet tent. There's certainly room for that. The only other, you know, thing I like to warn people about, or at least prepare them for, is that this is a very sandy environment. You are on a sandbar. Sand will get everywhere. And if you're not careful, the worst place to get it is in your food. So, you know, it's certainly worth a little bit of careful planning when you set up your kitchen and when you're cooking and, you know, keeping people away from the food and kicking sand in everything you eat. You know, nothing ruins your sandwich or your brat quite like a crunchy bit of seasoning, if you want to call it. But yeah, other than that, I mean, it really is it's a fairly straightforward thing. And it's, like I said, a great intro to people that wanted to do more of a kind of remote dispersed camping experience.
You and I were talking about my experience a little bit before the call. And yes, the sandy food is not fun. So good pointer for people to have. So
for sure, yeah.
Let's talk about what you all offer. So there's transportation, people can rent a kayak or a canoe. Can you talk about how this process works?
You know, I guess the very first thing we try to do, and this applies to everybody, not even just our customers, but anybody that is looking for information on how to go out on this river and, you know, not have the experience where they never want to come back, you know, like we were kind of talking about. And, you know, that starts with kind of dumping everything we know onto the website, you know, what to expect, what it's like, you know, the logistics of the bathrooms, things like that. But even like, you know, safety on the river. What to be aware of, what to be prepared for, you know, what happens if weather comes up, all those kind of things. Like, you know, they're all important. And I think knowing all of that ahead of time will kind of make it a more comfortable experience. So after we've kind of got that information out of the way, people have decided this is for them, they want to come out with us, you know, they'll make a reservation. And so, yeah, we provide transportation. They come out to us. We kind of park everybody at the end of their trip, which is a little bit unique. So then when we can take people upriver, drop them off, and they kind of paddle back to their cars. And so they're able to finish on their pace. You know, you're not worried about trying to paddle as fast as you can to, you know, oh my gosh, the bus is going to leave in 3 minutes and we're 10 miles away. Like, what's going to happen? We're stranded. That's kind of one of the big selling points of our transportation system. You know, of course, we also provide the canoes, the kayaks, there's dry bags, there's, you know, all the kind of firewood accessories that you might want to have out on the river that people wouldn't normally necessarily have on their own.
So how far do people need to paddle?
We cover a fairly small part of the river. We focus more on the overnight trips, kind of like a weekend or long weekend type options. We've got 10, 18, 25 mile options. There are, you know, it's perfectly reasonable to do the full 92.3 miles from the last dam all the way to the Mississippi. I've, you know, done that a few times, and it's a great experience. The entire river is worth being on. I personally think our Mazamani to Spring Green area is the prettiest by far, but you know, it's all good.
This part of the Wisconsin River is pretty shallow. I read that maybe somebody walked it in your first year that you were open. So water levels do play a pretty big role in these trips. You've had some high water and cancellations this year. What are the ideal conditions that are needed?
Yeah, so some cancellations this year, certainly an understatement. We are very much dependent on kind of the rainfall in the greater Wisconsin area. You know, this river drains a third of the state. And so water levels, of course, if there's nowhere to stop, nowhere to camp, that's a problem. And so what you're really looking for, everything's kind of measured in cubic feet per second. We're looking for under 15,000 cubic feet per second. When you get below that, you know, your sandbars start coming up, you've got places to stop, places to camp. And then beyond that, you know, really you could go anytime you wanted to. We've got people that come out in April. We've got people that come out all the way into the fall with the leaves. I've paddled this river in the winter. I don't recommend that, but you can certainly do it. But the, you know, the ideal, you're looking for the weather to be in that nice, pleasant three time temperature, like 70, 80 degrees. So yeah, if you really had to choose something, you know, that nice low, late summer, low water level, lots of sandbars to choose from, light winds, maybe a little breeze out of the east, kind of push you along a little bit so you can float, do a little bit less work. And of course, you know, sunny is beautiful. And then got your nice crisp nights for some campfires, and I'd say that's where it's at for sure.
So Wisconsin River, as you said, a beautiful place to canoe or kayak. But Amanda, if people want to plan a trip elsewhere, there are some other paddling experiences people can try out in the state. So let's start with the Wausau Whitewater Park.
This is a great option to fuel your adventurous side. It's an artificial whitewater paddling course right in downtown Wausau. The Wausau Whitewater Park opens specific weekends throughout the summer when the dam that feeds it is open. So that's what creates the optimal flow for whitewater paddling. And you can paddle through 12 different whitewater features. And during these events, they call them recreational releases, you can actually sign up for lessons and learn the skills that you need to pick up the sport. So it really is approachable for folks of all skill levels. But also spectating can be just as fun, especially when they host these elite level competitions. They're hosting the Midwest Freestyle Championships August 17th through the 18th.
And where are some other good places you'd recommend people try out kayaking or canoeing?
I suggest checking out the Kickapoo River for a more serene experience. The narrow river meanders through the heart of the Driftless region. It's lined by these stunning sandstone cliffs topped by trees that help shade the river. And when the water levels are right, you can kayak, canoe, or tube the Kickapoo. And you can rent equipment from a variety of outfitters like Kickapoo Wild Adventures in Ontario. Paddling at a state park is also a good option. Many of our parks have lakes or rivers that run through them, and several state parks also rent adaptive kayaks for folks with disabilities to enjoy the water. The outriggers on these kayaks provide more stability in the water, and they also have adjustable seats for a more comfortable, secure experience. You can find adaptive kayaks at places like Yellowstone Lake State Park in southern Wisconsin and Buckhorn State Park in central Wisconsin.
Okay, so back to the Wisconsin River. What else might people want to do if they plan a long weekend to do a Wisconsin River trip?
For an unexpected activity on the Wisconsin River, take a ride on the Merrimack Ferry. The ferry is just a short drive from Sauk Prairie, and it's the only free ferry in Wisconsin. It's a quick ride. You'll ride across the river in about 7 minutes, and you'll want to make sure to treat yourself to some ice cream at the Merrimack Scoop on the south side of the river. You'll also want to make a visit to Wollersheim Winery and Distillery when you're in the area. It certainly impresses visitors. You can go on a guided tour and learn about the historic property. It was originally used as a vineyard back in the 1840s. And then you can also enjoy the spirits that Wollersheim distills, like their brandy. That's going to help complete the perfect Wisconsin old fashioned. And if you visit travelwisconsin.com/foodiepass, you can actually get a free digital pass with access to exclusive food and drink deals at more than 100 different culinary establishments throughout the state. And Wollersheim Winery and Distillery is offering a free mini bottle of wine with the purchase of a regular size bottle of wine. So you might want to check that out while you're there.
Nice. So, Ryan and Amanda, I think what's really cool about canoeing or kayaking the Wisconsin River is it's kind of what you make of it. You can get a big group together, go solo, go with a friend. You could meet people on the river. You can paddle your heart out to reach the best sandbar or kind of take it easy and just float your way down, making stops along the way. It can kind of just be whatever is fun for you. So could you both describe your ideal trip down the Wisconsin River?
Yeah, my ideal trip on the Wisconsin River, you know, for years it had been going out with a group of friends. And, you know, interestingly, in the last couple of years, you know, we've all had kids. And so now it's honestly gotten so much better going with the kids. And I never would have thought that. So my ideal trip is, believe it or not, bringing, you know, 10 or 12 of our friends and all their kids. And so you've got this group hanging out on the water. The kids are just having this blast of a time. It's a giant sandbox, really. And so they're just swimming, running, playing around. And, you know, the adults, of course, providing some supervision, but also it's just a great time for all of us to catch up, hanging around by the fire after, you know, living our daily lives, trying to chase these kids around. And now they're all kind of semi-contained. And it's such a fun experience for me. I would do that, continue to do that every year. And so hopefully that'll continue on long into the future as well.
Well, I will never forget my first paddling experience with my husband. I had never been in a canoe before, and he grew up canoeing, so his family had gone for years. And at one point, he decided that we should switch places in the canoe. So, of course, he's just starting to move over, and I'm frozen in my seat. And so then our weight isn't distributed, and it gets tippy, and we're spinning. And we did not end up tipping the canoe over, but we certainly shared a ton of laughs, and I have learned a ton about canoeing since then. So for me, really, that ideal experience is sharing some laughs, making some great memories, Certainly stopping at those sandbars, packing a wonderful picnic lunch. We have not taken our little ones out yet on a paddling trip, but I'm looking forward to that. Ryan, like you said, I think that so many opportunities to make memories and just really enjoy being in nature in such a unique experience on the Wisconsin River. And I think that represents a lot of what makes Wisconsin so special in the summertime. It's our endless access to freshwater playgrounds. It's that natural beauty that really draws folks here. It's sharing those memories with whoever you're with and exploring at your own pace, finding reasons to stop and explore on your way to and from that destination too.
Can relate, Amanda. Similar experience. Thank you both so much for joining me for Wandering Wisconsin.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, this is great. Thank you.
Amanda Weibel is the communications officer for Travel Wisconsin. Ryan Schmudlock is the owner of the Wisconsin Canoe Company. They both spoke with Lake Effect's Becky Mortensen for Wandering Wisconsin. You can find information on how to book your canoeing and camping trip at WUWM.com, along with other travel recommendations you can do right here in our home state. And Wandering Wisconsin wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll help break down the constitutional amendments on the ballot in the upcoming August election. That's tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.